Hi, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast and happy Cinco de Mayo. First of all, this is episode 283, Permaculture Scaled Up and Scaled Down. It is part two in our Autonomy Through Agorism series. Jamin joins me again today, and his wife Karen is on the show this time, and I'd like to thank them again for devoting their time to this project. So the first part of our discussion is devoted to scaling permaculture up. In other words, the story of how Jamin and Karen started on a very small lot in a densely populated area, not at all really conducive to farming, in Pittsburgh, and how they slowly grew to where they are today on 12 plus acres. And we're going to discuss just about everything that goes on there. Then we're going to scale down to a noob like me who is looking to do his first garden in my little yard here in Keene, New Hampshire. Now, before we, do you mind if I just tell you a little bit of behind-the-scenes stuff about the show? I'll make it quick, okay, because there's an issue, and you can help me solve it. Thousands of you can help me solve this problem. The last show, number 282, was part 8 in our self-esteem series. It is called Self-Esteem in Schools. The show's been out since last Thursday. It has barely over 1,000 downloads. And that is about a quarter of what it should have by this point after being out 4 or 5 days. Now, here's why that happened. I posted it very close to the Education Freedom Report. And if two episodes get posted very close together, the one that's behind the most recent one, a lot of people miss. And you should hear it. Wes and I have a great conversation. I think it's pretty well produced. And I hope you'll go download it and share it on Facebook or Twitter. That really, really helps new people find the show. So that's episode 282, Self-Esteem in the Schools. Also, I just got back into Keene after spending the last 3 days in the middle part of the state at our friend Osborne's house. His family was out of town, and he said, "Do you want to come have like a bachelor kind of thing?" So, and you're saying, what does that mean? Well, it meant a lot of things. We had some nice snacks. We had some good talks. We watched some shows, including a couple episodes of Game of Thrones. And on Friday night, we did a 6-hour live show. Some of it will wind up in the podcast. Some of it will not. We had a great interview with a friend of ours named Kirk, who is involved in some educational projects here in New Hampshire. Carlos Morales sat with us for a couple hours. We talked to Objectivist Girl. Her name is Lauren, and she has a YouTube channel primarily focused on objectivism. And then our old friend Brian, great friend of the show, great friend of mine, joined us once again for the last portion of the show. You might remember Brian from the Sester Sent Episodic Gala. We talked about permaculture. He returns to talk about chickens. And you're saying, great, I have so many questions about chickens. Well, good news, many of them will probably be answered in this conversation that we have. I also eat raw eggs during that portion of the show, so you would probably want to check that out, I'm thinking. And that's it. The only other thing I can think of is send us Bitcoin. I have a couple of pretty expensive pieces of equipment that I need for the show. One is a new computer. The other is a Symetrex voice processor. I'm actually looking at a few different preamps and compressors and voice processors. You know, we're talking over $1,000 in expenses there. And I would like to buy these things with Bitcoin in a promotional effort with one of these Bitcoin stores. I'm going to talk to somebody there and see if they'll do like a 50-50 thing. But for that to happen, I need more of those Bitcoin sent to me. So if you're one of these Bitcoin millionaires, or even at this point, I guess, Bitcoin thousandaires, consider making a Bitcoin donation to schoolsucksproject.com. And we'll be back with another show in the latter half of this week. Take care. First of all, I would like to welcome back Jamin. How are you doing today?
Pretty good, Brett. How are you?
I'm doing well. And we are also joined by Karen, and you two are married and parents, and you run this farm that we were talking about last week. Hi, Karen.
Hello. It's nice to be here, Brett.
It's nice to have you. So what I said when we concluded last week, which was our introduction to this subject, is that we would go through, in our second show, your whole story. And what I really wanted to know, and what I really think is helpful for a lot of people in my audience to know, is how and where this all started and where the interest came from as well. So this goes back to pretty much right out of high school, right?
Actually, even before then, probably 20 years ago, we actually started to go out into the woods and identify herbs with a local man who would pick different things for companies and sell it to them by the pound. So it was an interest that we had. I guess it was almost in medicinal herbal medicine at that point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely.
And coincidentally, we had a teacher that we became friends with that was actually interested in herbal medicine as well. And we started identifying herbs, doing more with gardening, and ended up on a farm exchanging work for rent, mm-hmm. doing organic gardening. So we were introduced to that then, taking care of rabbits and taking care of chickens at that point. We also ran into a couple that had built a beautiful stone house by themselves, completely independent off the grid, with water from rainwater collection, solar power, mm-hmm. turbine, wind power, completely having their own food sources and actually only working part-time minimally. You know, they had a lot of autonomy in their life and really enjoyed it. And it was something I think we both really admired and had set out a goal to make that what we wanted as part of our life.
Yeah, that place was a real inspiration.
Yeah, and Jamin, you said this guy had invested like maybe a total of $20,000 in this whole homestead.
Yeah, $20,000 was the, I think, the build price. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure about the property.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of space there. It was completely off-grid. It was solar with a pretty large battery bank. The house, you know, took advantage of some design aspects, like there was a compost area right when you walked out, like through the sun porch type thing that he could grow stuff in, and he actually had compost worms in that area. He had like a spiral tower that had a library in it. it was just a real inspiration. You know, we were amazed.
Yeah, that's very cool. And have you guys heard of, this is not to go in a different direction here, I think this kind of relates. It definitely made me think of these tiny homes. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. We've been keeping up with the all the different styles and stuff. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, which seems like they're... I was talking to a friend recently who has a bit of property, and he was thinking about setting up some kind of operation where people could come and build them. And from what I understand, they're very affordable, and they can also make use of a lot of recycled materials, and they're mobile, and they don't take that long to manufacture. And then you can just take them somewhere else. And I thought that was a very neat idea. Certainly not for everybody. But what was the size of this homestead that this guy had built back in the day?
I would say it was as big as our other house, like 900 square feet or so.
Mm-hmm.
It was.
It was pretty massive. I mean, that's what was so impressive about it, too. I mean, massive for what it was, a cabin in the woods. And there were a lot of natural design elements in, like there was a tree you had to climb to get from one level to the next.
So you said you were inspired by this man and what he had done. So tell me how you guys got started after that, like actually going and, you know, trying to obtain your own property and get started on your path to where you are today.
Well, we were looking for a deal on a place so we didn't have to be paying rent and that we could get a return on the investment, because where we were moving, we had no plans of staying there at all.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is we found an estate sale, and we paid like $8,000, I think it was, for a whole estate in a rundown neighborhood in Pittsburgh. Basically, what had happened is these previous owners had died, and to settle all the tax liabilities, and I don't know if they owed money to the bank on the house or what, the family was selling the house before it was going to get foreclosed mm-hmm. on, basically. So we bought that and lived there for a while. Well, Karen went to school.
And I went to school. Basically, the whole point of it was to get some capital to invest to get more autonomy. So it's kind of a weird situation, but you have to have some way to get to the means that you're looking for. So I did something that I had an intrigue to learn and that I thought would be useful in other things in life, in health. Everybody has an investment in their own health. So this was a very practical thing for me to do. I do enjoy it, but gardening and doing what we do here on our little farm is that's my life's work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a means to do that. So while we were down in Pittsburgh, I ended up stopping at a bigger chain grocery store one day, getting about 8 flats of vegetable and flower plants for next to nothing, and ended up digging up our whole entire front yard and planting the front yard with fruits and vegetables. Mm. So I've had a desire to do this forever. It was very interesting. This was a very poor neighborhood in Pittsburgh. My neighbors and the neighbors' children had never seen any vegetable plants.
Wow.
They were astonished to see an actual tomato growing. So it's really inspiring, and I'm really encourage like the urban garden movement. There shouldn't be a child out there that doesn't know what a tomato plant looks like or that tomatoes come from a plant.
I agree. Or that tomatoes are something other than pizza sauce or ketchup. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, the ketchup thing. That's even scarier.
So was anybody inspired enough to maybe try like a little garden of their own in this rundown part of Pittsburgh?
I don't think they thought we were crazy. Like, they kept telling me it was poison ivy that we were growing.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah, they kept telling us that we were going to get the ivy poison if we didn't do something about the lawn. And we tried to explain to them that they were tomato plants and it didn't go over as well as we would hope.
Mm.
Now, I think some people did walk by with appreciation and would comment, and some of the other kids in the neighborhood would make comments that, what are you doing and why are you doing that? And I was able to explain to them what vegetables were, why you would plant them. So maybe some of them actually had some idea when they got a little older.
Oh, yeah. It was just the adults that we interacted with kind of had the attitude that I was talking about.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can completely see that. So this is where you are in this kind of rough part of town near Pittsburgh. And Karen, you're in nursing school. And Jamin, what are you doing at the time?
I was basically getting into the IT field through the route of independent certification.
Mm-hmm.
Basically hack schooled myself. My first internet access device was like a Sega Saturn with Netlink that I got really cheap because I couldn't afford a computer at the time. So I taught myself computer repair and basic networking and stuff with that. And I started buying computers and, you know, tearing them apart and upgrading them and reselling them, and got into like the computer recycling thing where I was getting recycled computers cheap and upgrading them and making them usable machines for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically before there were your sub $300 desktops, when everything was like a grand or so, you know, giving people decent internet computers they could run their Netscape Navigator on, you know.
Yeah, I remember. Now, well, one of the other things I wanted to know, how long ago are we talking all of this was happening?
Like late 90s.
Late 90s. So were you still very much in your right-wing militia mindset then?
No, not really. After I figured out what that was about, I figured out that was just another trap, and I just didn't really have time to think about that type of stuff. I was pretty OCD about the computer stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I would just read technical manual after technical manual after exam prep book, or I really didn't devote much thought to other, you know, anything else other than I already knew was all fraudulent.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. The reason why I ask is I was just wondering how a mindset like that would get go over in this neighborhood that you're describing to me. And obviously, it seems like there might have been some dangers associated with living in this place, right?
Oh, yeah. Just random people that just are in a bad mood was the type of scenarios that you'd run into down there. Or the attempted car robbery. We caught people a couple times. Just, you know, different close calls where in situations like that, you just kind of think after the fact that it would have probably been a good idea to be armed.
Yeah.
If you weren't able to negotiate out of it, which I've always been able to negotiate out of situations like that, but, you know, that's with semi-reasonable people, and sometimes people aren't even semi-reasonable, so.
Sometimes they are not. So I think that, unless you guys have anything else to add, I think that concludes, like, the first phase of this whole journey, where you're certainly standing out as the only people who, in an area, who know how to even deal with vegetables. But after some time went by, you upgraded and got out of the city, right?
Yeah, basically that place had outlived its usefulness.
And as soon as we had enough money to put a deposit down and for a house in the country, we were there.
Yeah.
The first house we bought was a beautiful place. It was 3.5 acres, but it was unfortunately a 2-bedroom house. There were some other issues of different outbuildings and things we needed. But we started to do more with organic gardening. We did some raised tire beds. We obtained chickens. I learned how to prune fruit trees. We had blueberry bushes there, raspberry bushes. We were first and finally able to actually start preserving some food for ourselves.
Now, how are you learning the... I mean, I understand the garden is the first step, and I would think, like most things, once you, you know, have one phase or one discipline under control, you want to expand. So as you move to this new house and you did expand, how are you learning, or what resources were you trying to take advantage of as far as, you know, what to do next?
We have a pretty decent collection of books, and we like to hit up library sales. There was a discount book place near us that I basically got most of my certification prep books from, you know, 10% of the cover price. Basically, I've, you know, learned to find resources cheap and free.
Another perfect place now that you can look for pruning a tree, for instance, they have great YouTube videos. Before, it was like looking in the book and trying to figure out exactly where you're supposed to make the cuts. They just, you know, it's amazing how the internet has changed the way that we can research how to garden and how to take care of plants and animals. So,
yeah.
I started reading a book, and I found when I was in doing the tire garden, the use of companion planting. And I started to do that, which is basically having plants work together beneficially to help your garden productivity and reduce pest problems.
So what's an example of that companion planting? I'm curious.
Well, the easiest and most common one would be the four sister plants.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I love to do it. It looks really neat as well. You have a ground covering of a low-level clover, like white clover. That helps to fix nitrogen in the soil for the plants to grow. You have corn that grows up, and up the corn you'll grow beans. So the corn becomes the pole for the beans. The beans also add nitrogen to the soil to help feed the corn. And then around there, you plant a squash, like pumpkin, butternut squash, and that helps to mulch over the soil to prevent other weeds from growing up. And it also helps to keep the soil a little cool so that it retains your water. So all those things work together. Otherwise, where people would just plant corn and use petrochemicals on it to prevent anything else from growing.
Should, in this effort to force the earth to do what they want it to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is an old way of Native Americans, how they would plant their food crops.
Yeah, various tribes. It was real popular. They called it the Three Sisters. We actually add an additional plant to the group, actually more than one, but we typically also grow some beneficial insect-attracting plants around our Three Sisters or our Four Sisters gardens. Basically, a lot of those are just self-seeded. You know, that's another type of companion, is one that will draw in beneficial insects.
The reason why I'm asking is I'm actually getting ready to do my first small garden. We have to start somewhere.
Nice. You know? Wonderful.
Yes, yes. So I'm very interested in, and it's hard to figure out where to start. How long were you guys at this before you felt just the gardening? I mean, let's just focus on that for now, and then we'll bring the animals into it. Before you felt like you really knew what you were doing and you were seeing these sustainable results. And I guess this would probably be your experience at both of these properties now. But how many years or how much time was it before you felt comfortable with what you were doing?
Actually, it really didn't take too long.
No.
We started to do the gardening at this new place the first year, and we were very surprised. We were pretty successful in how much we were able to do. And at that point, I started to do some canning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we started experimenting with different methods. The first methods we used, you know, we could be using them now and they were productive. But we were constantly trying to refine to figure out the methods with the least input. We actually started off copying what we learned at the farm. And they did a type of plastic culture that uses black plastic, and you plant through the black plastic, and it's a type of exclusion mulching. And that actually works relatively good. It has some drawbacks, and it doesn't really add any real amount of organic matter to the soil like a mulch does or anything. But, you know, we basically wanted a less labor-intensive version of that even, because that involved tilling and intensive weeding, you know, to get the bed ready and everything. Mm-hmm. So we really began experimenting with how little input can you put into, you know, like, let's scratch up the ground and throw some of these seeds down and experiment for ourselves. And there's a lot of stuff that's greatly exaggerated about doing things that come from people's traditions and everything else. And I wanted to see exactly what, you know, how much input do you have to get versus how much output versus how much area you have to work with. And to make a better ratio with higher returns and less input out of that.
Now, I mean, I'm guessing there's like numerous calculations for how much food are you trying to grow and produce on the property as a percentage of how much you need. How many people are you trying to feed, obviously, would be an important calculation. But you said you're still not what you would call at this point fully self-sustaining, right?
Not at this point, but a lot of the reason are the concurring projects and skill sets I've been acquiring, the resources that has taken in the kind of in the meantime here. We've been devoting more and more time each year to doing the food production thing. Mm-hmm. We're at a point now where we can devote a significant amount of time to it and actually start to yield surplus from it.
The vegetables we have a pretty good handle on. Dealing with fruit, it's becoming quite tricky. We have an old orchard at our property. And unfortunately, the last 2 years, frost has killed our flowers. So we've had a lack of apples and pears. Otherwise, we've started to plant new apple trees, new berries, that type of thing. So the fruit is something that needs to have some work. And also, unfortunately, dairy. That's something that we really would like, is to have a dairy cow and to do our own dairy products.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why I asked about now is you're on considerably much more land than you were when you were on these 3.5 acres, right? Jamin, you said last time you have like 11 or 12, right?
Yeah, we have like 12 and a half.
What do you think you need? And you have a family of 4 and 5 on the way, right?
Right. Yeah.
So if you were going to feed everybody off the land, do you need that much land? Could it be done with a lot less land?
Yeah, it could be done with a lot less. We could have done it at the 3-acre property, but we wanted to be able to do a larger scale and actually have surplus to be able to finance the rest of everything else. Basically, what we're doing here is we have a half acre that is at the front of the rest of the property. And that half acre is fenced now, and it is basically the zone one of the permaculture system that we're building. And the zone one is basically your center zone in permaculture design that you spend the most time in doing things. And it's usually placed around your daily paths that you take to, you know, even, you know, if you had a small urban lot, you would place your zone one, your path to your mailbox, or, you know, your path to your driveway to get to your car or something. So basically, we have this whole half acre zone one that we're actually doing in a way that it is going to be an example of what you can do on a half acre. and be a self-contained system to the extent that you can in that amount of space. And then we have other zones that are going to radiate out from there. And the second zone is our other animal production, which includes the rabbits and pigs. And within the second zone, there is also large garden beds for growing calorie crops for people and animals. So we basically grow a couple hundred pounds of potatoes every year, mm-hmm. with more every year. And we are starting to grow a plant called sunchoke, or Jerusalem artichoke, a lot of people call it. And it is really good for this, because just about every animal will eat it if you prepare it the way the animal will eat it. And it's prolific to the point of being a nuisance where you don't want it to grow. And it is basically a plant in the sunflower family that gets an edible tuber about the size of a potato that is supposed to taste like water chestnuts. And there are so many benefits to this. I mean, you can even make alcohol out of it. The whole plant is usable. You know, the rabbits will eat all the foliage. The pigs will eat the foliage. A lot of permaculture systems, this is like a backbone calorie crop for animal feed. So we're adding beds of that this year, whereas I had actually established wild patches of it all over the 12 acres. So like taking a walk around the property, you might find 15 patches that are just multiplying every year. Every year they send more shoots up, to the point they're going to take over the small places that I planted them. And then we're also establishing other plants like that.
Well, we're going to try a new guild with that system. We're going to do the sunchokes with a field pea and an amaranth and some clover, and try to get a sort of sustainable livestock feed going in the back zone too, so we don't have to be as dependent on buying feed at the store.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one thing to have animals, but then you're buying feed on top of it, and you can't always get organic feed, which is a problem around this area. So that's the downfall, is going to the feed store and hearing about a farmer buying a 250-gallon drum of Roundup. It doesn't make your day, you know?
Yeah.
So we're so excited about doing these calorie crops for the animals this year, and I really hope that is something beneficial for us.
Yeah, we're also adding Japanese sweet potatoes this year for our calorie crop.
So what you guys are interested in as far as the scale is concerned is surplus. Was that pretty much what made you make the decision to move to the larger property? Or,
well, there were a lot of factors. This larger property has a lot of outbuildings that I've turned into various type workshops. I mean, I have an automotive workshop, I have a woodworking shop, I have a general purpose workshop, I have a gym, and I have another workshop that is basically storage right now that is going to be something eventually, probably a indoor rabbit setup with aquaponics in the basement of that building.
Oh, wow.
I have a lot of capital here, actually. I mean, that's the way we look at it. And we spent a lot of our budget for the past couple years here just trying to make all that stuff sustainable, because everything needed new roofs. And I mean, this was an older farm that was actually the last thing it did productively. It was an apiary. And so we have this building that was used for the USDA inspection, because I don't know the specific red tape about it. He had to have a separate building with like separate septic and everything else just to run the bee operation. So we have that, you know, and it has a foundation. And what we want to eventually do is put a solarium on the south side of that thing and do aquaponics in the basement, like all even in the winter. But that's going to be our large-scale aquaponics system. And this year we're doing our small-scale system in a greenhouse in the Zone 1. As an example of what a small-scale system with a 10x12 greenhouse that's very easy to replicate can produce.
So we've talked about this first zone and a little bit about what's going on beyond it.
Yeah.
But because there's 12-plus acres here, what are the plans for the rest of the land, even beyond what we've discussed so far?
Yeah.
Especially as far as producing a surplus is concerned.
Well, the Zone 2 is the actually we implement the calorie crop and the larger animal operations. That's about our Zone 2. We have an orchard that could be considered Zone 2. It's maybe 4 mature pear trees and 2 apple trees,
mm-hmm.
that is productive once in a while if it's a good year. And we have some nut trees that are also in the Zone 2, we have black walnuts. And then after the Zone 2, our Zone 3 would basically be like meadow for the animals that we want to be able to put out to pasture. But what we're doing is we're slowly building that. We have a mobile hog solution here that works much like a chicken tractor does with chickens. If people aren't familiar, it's just a mobile coop that they will scratch the ground up in their wake, and you can plant, or you have fertilized soil in their wake too. Well, you can do the same thing with pigs, and what we're doing is trying to get some better food for them growing in their wake. Stuff like the sunchoke I was talking about. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of perennial crops that you can grow, and a lot of vegetables that will self-seed. And we're basically also trying to plant our Zone 4, which is the kind of the forest garden zone, in the wake of them too. So different areas will be planted with fruit trees after they've been there for a while. Different areas will be planted more with meadow. And it will all be, kind of dispersed together. It's not going to be big blocks of things. It's just going to be trying to make it a very natural looking place.
Yeah.
One that would have more purpose for us. A lot of the things that are there, just in a regular meadow might be good for a cow, but for a pig, they need different types of food items, and especially humans even. So we're going to be planting some chestnut trees and with that as well. And that's a very good crop for pigs to be eating.
Mm-hmm. We already have productive chestnut trees, and I've been saving their saplings, and we have a nice collection that we're going to be planting out this year in the wake of the pigs. And chestnut is a traditional pig feed when it's available. And when I say traditional, I mean hundreds of years ago, traditional.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's actually supposed to produce a really unique tasting end product too. So it's going to be interesting. We feed them a little bit, but hand collecting chestnuts is not exactly a very good use of time compared to just letting them roam through a place where all the chestnuts fell.
Yeah.
I think it would make happier animals too, which is a concern of mine. They're happy to root around and look for their own food, and that's, part of their being pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Just have it more natural for them going through shifts instead of being contained in one center location their whole life.
Yeah, and so these particular pigs will, they may never see the actual end product, but, future generations of them will.
So you feel like this is the place? Don't envision, I should say, your needs expanding beyond what you have now?
Well, one thing that is really cool about this place is that it has gravity-fed water from a pond that's about an acre surface area. Mm-hmm. So that's really a big deal, because as far as thinking of being off-grid and everything, that's one of the main issues you have, is pumping water around. So we actually have irrigation from that pond, at multiple places on the property with a tap coming out of the ground.
Oh, neat.
So we have a lot of opportunities for stuff like that. And plus, I am in the future going to be doing more aquaculture in the pond. The pond's already stocked with different sport fish and catfish. And it's actually, there's a lot of fish in there. It's like 17 feet deep in the deepest area. And it's like an area or an acre surface area. So I'd have to find a place that had something like that or better. Because what this is like is, if you ever, I'll have to give you links for the show notes, but there's a guy, Sepp Holzer, who's like a permaculture, like a modern permaculture pioneer. He has a farm in Austria called the Krameterhof. And I really like how this property is set up, because it's like a microcosm of that. Because he has all these ponds that he has irrigation from. There's terraces cut out of hills. It's very similar to the setup he has there. And there's just so many opportunities having all that water available.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's actually a stream that runs down through the property that I have access to. There's multiple springs that are at high points. There's just a lot of good things to have at this place. The soil isn't very great, but that is something that can be fixed relatively easily just through some patience and growing the right cover crops to let the soil regenerate naturally, and adding the animals through there to add some fertilizer.
Yeah, now there's no quick fix for that that's natural, right? And it really just is something that requires patience. Because I've been, you know, like I mentioned earlier, I've been planting a small, modest garden of my own, and I've been walking around the property where I live. And, you know, I'm not too excited about how the ground looks, and I'm wondering what to do about that.
Well, raised beds are great. Double digging is a really good way to establish a bed.
And what is that?
It's a technique where you dig a trench. You mark off your bed, you dig a trench, you put the soil to that trench in a wheelbarrow or buckets, you set it aside. Then you take a fork, like a spading fork, a heavy-duty one, and you spade the subsoil with it. You can either just aerate it, or you can actually break up the subsoil. And it's, you know, it's going to depend on the quality of your tools and your ambition, because, you know, like my subsoil, I aerate it the first time when I'm doing that method because it's heavy clay.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so you aerate that with the fork, and then you dig another ditch or another trench right in front of that one, and you use the fill from that trench to fill your first one. And then you do the exact same thing with aerating the subsoil. And basically, when you're done, you'll get to a point where you don't have any fill, and you use the fill you put aside to fill the last area up.
Now you say subsoil, so I assume there's going to need to be a higher quality of soil that people would have to have. And is this something that it's okay to buy? Is there, you know, what were they called? The additives? I mean, are you buying stuff with additives in it, or how does that work if you're just kind of like a small scale amateur gardener?
Well, it really depends on, I mean, there are so many methods at work. Not knowing how many square feet you're thinking for your gardens, I would recommend something like a raised tire bed, or even a conventional raised bed, just because it's a lot easier. You can buy the fill and you can fill it. Like basically you'd go to a landscaping place and they would have topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get the topsoil and then you could buy organic amendments. There are other ways. Like what we typically do is we use fill from different construction projects to fill our raised beds. So we have been digging a foundation for our aquaponics greenhouse for a couple years here, and basically using what we take from that is fill for the various projects we have. So, I mean, that's another way you can get fill and basically use, you know, do two things at once, basically take a waste and make turn it into a resource.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is composting. If you're the, you know, it takes a long time if you don't have a lot of waste to compost, though.
Yeah.
Another one that is very good, but usually if you're just starting off with like lawn that isn't very fertile, takes a few years to come into full fertility, is a method called sheet mulching. And basically what you do is you do put down whatever organic amendments you can get. You know, typically if you're going to go the landscaping place route, it'll be like mushroom compost and maybe composted manure or something.
Mm-hmm.
You put that down, and then you can, if you have it, you can put more organic matter down, like straw, like a layer of straw or, you know, compost. Or if you want, you can buy different amendments, depending on how patient you are for it to become a very fertile bed.
Yeah, that's actually a good question about the patience, like the time frame of how long I would be in a place. See, this is the kind of the trick for me is I typically don't stay anywhere very long. You know, I'm just, that's how I am. I'm somewhere for 2 years and I just want to go somewhere else. So it's an interesting thing to think about getting into because, yeah, I don't really stick around anywhere too long. And I'm realizing that for real success, it might require that.
Well, it doesn't take a whole lot of fertility to do the tire bed method.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm interested in hearing more about that. What is that? Why do you think that was developed? And, you know, whatever you guys want to say about it is probably helpful.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to it. They're basically indestructible containers to garden in, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
They actually add a fair amount of heat for plants that like that if you put them in the right place. They act as, you know, solar heat collectors because they're black. So they have that going for them. They concentrate fertility in a small area. Like, let's say a 27-inch truck tire with the sidewalls cut out. You have a 28-inch container that's about 8 inches deep.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have to fill it all the way. You can basically just start adding stuff to it every year. And that's how we did it in Twin Rocks. I mean, the second property.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Basically, year after year, it gets more fertile, but you still are, you know, it's still growing in fertile soil the first year.
And it's not something that you have to till up again.
Yeah.
So you still will start to retain micronutrients, and then if you ever want to, you really could move the dirt.
Yeah, we actually did. We moved some here.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to part with that soil. We moved, I don't know, 5 large tires full at least.
Another thing, too, for someone that moves often or needs a portable garden, doing like 5-gallon buckets that are self-watering.
Oh, yeah.
Or another way to go, because you can always transport them wherever you're going.
So just we're talking just like regular plastic 5-gallon buckets?
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say self-watering, what do you mean? I know what it means. I mean, like, how does that work, I should say?
They have a water reservoir, and you basically fill the water reservoir, and there's different wicking methods you can use to wick the water up to the plant roots and still allow the air to get to the roots so the soil doesn't become anaerobic. And that will basically make them rot. Mm-hmm. So they're just systems with a fairly large reservoir that overcome the hardest challenge about growing things in containers. And that's you have to basically water them daily if you want them to be productive. These you don't. And there are other methods that are bigger than the buckets, too, depending on your situation. You can use plastic bins. There's a method of wicking bed that uses a coiled up piece of like vacuum cleaner hose with holes cut in it. And you basically bury that in the bottom of like any type of plastic bin, like let's say a 30-gallon plastic bin.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fill that bottom up with a fine gravel or sand. And then you put landscaping fabric over top of that. And then you put your soil. And you actually have a... you let the hose come out the top, and you use that as your fill for your water, and that water reservoir in the sand and in the convoluted tubing in there is significant, and it basically just wicks right up through the landscaping fabric into the root zone, and is a really good method of having something that's relatively portable.
Interesting. So is there any danger or debates about a danger of having these things in plastic or rubber with the heat that plastic or rubber might be exposed to in the summer? Or am I paranoid?
Well, it depends on the situation, really. The tires themselves, from the research I've done, the main concern is zinc. They have zinc locked up in them. But from what I've read, it's not something that's going anywhere. And that's the main concern for them. With the plastics, if you're not using a food-grade plastic, there's going to be some type of release agent that they use in the molds that is not going to be good for you. Now, the question is, how much is actually going to be transmitted to the plants through the soil? You know, that's up for debate. I haven't been afraid to use the standard, like, Rubbermaid or Sterilite totes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a better idea to get something like the food-grade barrels that you can get surplus if that's a concern, because they are food-grade and they don't have the toxic release agents in them or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of aquaponics, like small-scale aquaponic systems, are based off of, are those barrels and those. They call them totes. And you have to have a pretty clean environment to be keeping high densities of fish the way aquaponics people do.
Yeah. So you're saying
they're very sensitive to poison.
So, but all that being said, a couple old truck tires with the sidewalls cut out, maybe some 5-gallon buckets, and a couple of these plastic storage bins, you could have a pretty decent mobile, even, you know, on within a piece of property, garden.
Yeah,
absolutely. At that point, you'd actually have enough for definitely your summer food, and then could probably even save some from that. It's amazing how plentiful you can get with just limited amount of space doing companion planting.
Yeah, you can get a very high yield.
And what research or process goes into seeds, right? Because I know they have them at the hardware store, but is it that simple? I would assume there's obviously a lot you could know about it, but if someone was just getting started, what would be most helpful for them?
If you're planning to save them, you basically have to get open-pollinated or heirloom seeds. And the reason for that being is a lot of the hybrids out there will not breed true to what you bought a second time. They can be cross-pollinated with other things, and you might even end up with something closer to the wild version of the vegetable that you're trying to plant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, you might end up with a tomato plant that gets little nightshade berry-looking tomatoes on them that we've had for volunteer tomatoes that weren't heirloom. Basically, there's that. Then there is, you want to look at the information with the growing season that you have. You want to kind of compare that to information that you can get from the seed suppliers that's usually on the packet, like how many days to maturity, how long it takes to germinate. Like, you want to time all that stuff to fit your growing season. And when you get good at it, you can actually layer harvests of different things, so you're always having something that you're harvesting, and you're getting more than one harvest in the growing season just by choosing varieties that fit your time requirements.
Yeah, this is about as far as I had gotten so far. I mean, and obviously, since people all over the world might listen to this, in New England, as you guys know, we do have some narrow windows compared to other places. Well, there's a lot of things that need to be planted next week or the week after that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was kind of looking into all the different germination times and when they could be harvested. Yeah, and it's interesting. There is quite a bit of variation. It looks like it could make for a busy summer.
Oh, definitely. Really, you should be planting and harvesting all summer.
Yeah, so continue to plant. I guess that's just most of the dates that I've looked at are just like the first time you can do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And with a lot of that, if you look through multiple sources, you might find a variety that you can get, you know, multiple harvests out of. Stuff like beans. Like, beans, you should really plant every week or every 2 weeks, because you'll just get a continuous harvest. Bean plants produce a massive amount of food.
They're very easy to grow. Carrots are another thing you can just throw in there as seeds. Mm-hmm. They grow very easy. Zucchini grows very well just from throwing the seed right in the soil. Cucumbers, sunflowers, I've had great success, and I haven't started them necessarily, you know, in seed trays, although that's the optimal way to do things.
See, we do a cover crop mix where we're going to either plant next or someplace that we're trying to boost the fertility there. And we throw different types of vegetable seeds in with these plants that are primarily for enrichment of the soil and enrichment of the biodiversity in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So we throw the vegetable seeds in there. So it's really interesting to see, like, you know, how much labor and effort it takes to grow different things. And a lot of things you can get to self-seed, too, in that type of situation. Like, we have things like radishes that self-seed, and the broccoli-type plants will self-seed, especially, like, the more wild varieties like rapini.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also something interesting because, I mean, you don't even necessarily have to do a lot of prep work if you're doing it that way. I mean, that's a technique that you can use to do that. It's a technique called seed balls or seed bombs. And you're basically taking some quality compost, and some people use other amendments, and some clay, and the seeds you're going to plant, and you're rolling them up in balls and drying them. And you basically just toss them, you know, throughout your property. And if conditions are right, you get a lot of cool stuff growing.
Interesting. So there is one other thing that came to mind. You know, it seems like both of you are also, because, you know, we are talking about agorism here, developing a lot of skills that are very complementary to what we talked about today. You know, you talked about Jamin being more handy, being able to fix things, being inspired by this man who had these old tractors from the 30s, you know, that he just kept them running, and he, you know, cut out all kinds of overhead that way. And Karen, you are doing preserving and pickling and kimchi and all these other things that are complementing the primary operation there.
Right. And it is gaining autonomy through all of this, and, you know, eventually being to the point of having more independence with your life in general,
mm-hmm.
we'll also get to the point where you will primarily be doing this and have little input on the outside economy and have our food bank and help others through an exchange for their food and hopefully have healthier food for people.
Yeah, and that's definitely a good segue to the permaculture principles if that's something you still want to look into.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because one of the chief principles is returning the surplus. And basically there are different ways to do that, and one of the ways would be to do some mutual aid or, you know, charity with it.
Absolutely. And as far as all of that is concerned, the permaculture principles and all of the other tie-ins that we wanted to do, we can save that for next time and pick up there.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds great.
Well, I really appreciate both of you joining me again and sharing all of this information. It was really helpful for me. Helps me develop a clearer picture of what I might be trying to do in my little backyard here.
I can't wait to see some pictures, man.
And I think it's fulfilling for anyone, even if they start just a little tomato plant on the back of their patio. It can be just a very self-reliant thing to have your own tomatoes for the summer.
Yeah, I was thinking about starting very small and just seeing how it goes, and then in the coming years, go from there.
Sounds great.
That's what we did.
So I certainly appreciate you sharing the story as well, and we will continue in a week or so. I look forward to it.
Thanks
me too. Thanks a lot.
Me on.